puzzled a great many of you, I'm sure, to say something briefly about chronology, and then you can work that out perhaps better in the section. Now, what we've done up to now, briefly, chronologically considered, I have taken the story up roughly to the 1850s. Emancipation and the problems of emancipation, roughly to the 1850s. In The Rise of Modern Anti-Semitism, I will go a little beyond the 1850s, as a matter of fact, to 1876, but not beyond that. So that we will have treated emancipation and the problems of emancipation and the rise of modern anti-Semitism separately. After we've done that, we go to Eastern Europe, again up to the 1870s. And then I'm going to change the assignment sheet around, by the way. We shall then start with the 1870s and take the problem of assimilation and anti-Semitism together as one unit. And then the rise of Zionism after that, because they are so closely connected. If you want to put it more specifically, you can put it this way. The first thing we've studied is the period of emancipation. From about 1780, that is Mendelssohn's Jerusalem, to about 1820, through the Edict of Emancipation. Then, secondly, we went to the working out of the problem of emancipation, which took us roughly from the 1820s after the Edict to roughly 1850. Roughly 1850. Then we went to the rise of modern anti-Semitism, which means going back in time, because modern anti-Semitism, as I told you, arose together with emancipation. And we shall take it up really to the 1860, but for one special episode, we shall go up to 1876. So that is it. Then we go to Eastern Europe, and finally, from 1870 on, we take it all together, because by that time it belongs all together. The other details you can work out, and you should work out about this in your section. Now, last time I talked about how the rise of anti-Semitism became connected with the longings, if you like, inherent in 19th century mass movements, with the anti-capitalism, the nationalism, the democracy, the opposition of privileges of all sorts. And I mentioned at the end how this goes hand in hand with the building up of a Jewish stereotype. And that this is important for two reasons which come into it. First of all, the importance of symbols in politics. And these symbols are aesthetic symbols, so that politics and aesthetics are here intimately linked. As Canetti puts it, the examination of symbolic structures is a work not of reduction, but of integration. Of integration. A symbol, and a political symbol especially, though it might hold for religious symbols as well, expresses simultaneously several meanings and puts these meanings into a kind of unity. It gives a kind of new reality through these symbols, which have several meanings, but are integrated and in a way synthetic in that sense. You can reduce them to a single pre-existent expression. And from that single pre-existing expression, you can in fact discover a kind of process. Now this kind of symbol which you have, which is immediately said, connect with the ideas of beauty and ugliness. Because in the modern political symbolism, that is to say again, I say, symbolism connected with mass movements especially, and with any kind of modern politics, it transforms all politics into a drama, into a theater, which is essential for all mass movements and all mass politics. But that drama, that theater, depends to a very large extent on a symbolism which integrates with this visual that is objectified, concrete, and which is linked to ideas of beauty and ugliness. The ideas of beauty and ugliness to which the symbolism in the 19th century became linked are ideas of beauty and ugliness which come from the Greek revival of the 18th century, from what Winckelmann in his famous history of art called the beauty that is Greece, the glory that is Rome. What that meant is an ideal of beauty, which is a Greek ideal of beauty. In the Greek ideal, beauty depends upon proportion, above all, upon proportion, but also on a kind of external appearance that was popularized from the Renaissance onwards with the statues, Michelangelo's David, maybe familiar to you, but other statues of this kind, a kind of beauty which in the last resort is a beauty of proportion, but which is also a beauty of general appearance. This kind of beauty means then proportion, ideal measurement. But inasmuch as the Romantic movement coincided with the revival of classicism and the preoccupation of man's soul, man's internal composition, coincides with the rise of classicism, the outward is linked to that. The symbols are outward, objectified, but they stand for internal qualities. A symbol must always be a whole, never a part. It must be an integrated force, and therefore it must have outside and inside in one harmony. Therefore, the symbol of Greek beauty also stood for a symbol of behavior. It stood for the symbol of behavior, which had become normative, if you want to use that word, which had become normative in the 19th century. Honesty, bravery, family life, the middle class, virtue. Now, inasmuch as this symbol both has an idea of beauty and an idea of middle-class virtue to it, both these ideas, therefore, the Jew becomes the counter-symbol, not only through his appearance, to which I shall come back in a minute, but also to the inward quality which this appearance characterizes. Not, of course, honesty, bravery, and the middle-class virtues, but instead, cowardice, dishonesty, and shiftiness. How was this stereotype spread? It is clear in an examination which has been made from the year 1800 and on that the most dangerous enemies of the Jews were the educated rather than the uneducated class. That will always be true, by the way. The urban population, rather than the superstitious peasant class. I have illustrated that already by talking about Cusinero, by talking last time about trees, all highly educated people. The most virulent animosity comes, therefore, by a group of writers who proclaim themselves the champions of the oppressed. For it must be cleared, I must mention it again, that anti-Semitic riots like those of 1890 and 1840, which I mentioned, are no longer, after all, medieval terrorism, but they have the character of popular revolt. And these anti-Semitic riots will continue to have the character of popular revolt, not of medieval terrorism. The popular work by such writers spread the stereotype, and in that way it becomes a symbol associated with mass movement. In that way, apart from Tussenel, whom I've mentioned before, and whom you read in Lichtenstein, apart from Fries, whom I talked about last time, perhaps the most popular vehicle and the first for spreading the stereotype was a play by a man who called himself Setzer, a play called Our Acquaintances of 1816. That play is important, for again it is important in the spread of the stereotype. The play unleashed a veritable flood of anti-Jewish caricatures. In fact, it introduced a veritable flood of anti-Jewish caricatures, which served to fix the stereotype. The play put Jews on the stage as an integrated symbol, both in looks and personality. The personality, cowardice, vanity, love of money. As a father says in the play to the son, as follows: let people tread on you, let yourself be accused by the law, let yourself be beaten up, but you must become rich. In other words, this is the general characterization, and it links again with what I said before, the Jewish conspiracy, the finance capitalism, all of that. But the play has another factor, which becomes very important, the factor of language. It delineates the personality, the love of money, the cowardice, the shiftiness. But it also has outward symbol, first of all, of language. Now you must realize how important language was to the rising nationalism. That language, ever since Heller, was the essence, in a way, of nationality. Therefore, the accusation that the Jews cannot speak the German language properly was enormously important and really helped make the play more effective. For what the Jews speak in the play and what they will speak from now on in all anti-Semitic pamphlets to our day is a mixture of Yiddish and German. There is a German word for it, English has no equivalent, which is the word Mauschel. This is a specific word attached to a specific mixture of German and Yiddish, which Jews are made to speak from now on. Thus, for example, their superficial assimilation can be characterized. The characters in the play talk about Mozart, but they can't really pronounce it. They call it Mozart. And things of that nature suffuse the play, if you like. The language is important since Heller, in the 18th century, a sign of culture. But certainly, it's not only internal personality of language, it is external appearance as well. As the play puts it, as a character puts it in the play, by his hair and physiognomy, the Jew clearly shows how great the difference is between him and us. Not less is also the spiritual distance which separates us. Now this will remain. Later on, the anti-Semite influential which will come to him, Drumont, will repeat it in the 1880s. How he will put it is still more spectacular and still more enormous. Drumont will say in 1902, in fact, the Jew has the soul of a Bedouin who burns down a city in order to cook his egg. This statement by Drumont, that the Jew has the soul of a Bedouin who burns down a city in order to cook his egg, brings up another factor already in Caesar. The Jew is so different because he is an Oriental desert people. The Bedouin in that quotation has this level of symbolism, a desert people. Lastly, it is not only internal, external language, it is, if you like, four-dimensional. For there is the matter of smell as well. This goes back into the Middle Ages. What, there is even a word for it in the Middle Ages, the furtor judaicus, the Jewish smell. It now becomes associated in Caesar with the eating of garlic. This will remain. Now, you will ask me sooner or later, why garlic? I have no explanation, but it'll be very important. In the most popular German book of the 80s, Wilhelm Busch's comic books, the Jew is always associated with the smell of garlic. Perhaps some of you who are better acquainted with Jewish cooking will have perhaps an explanation. But I just don't know why the garlic, but I just mention it. The stereotype, therefore, is what every symbol must be, four-dimensional. It is internal, external, and it reaches out. That is its great strength. It is all-dimensional. This was indeed new, and that also is of the greatest importance. The Jewish stereotype grew is of relatively modern origin. Before the 19th century, you have it first in caricature, but not in the general picturing of the Jews. If you look at a medieval Jewish picture, there's nothing special except the dress, the yellow hat and so on. But there's nothing special. But with the 15th and 16th century, it begins only in caricature. With the 19th century, it begins to be generalized. For example, a National Socialist examination of anti-Semitic literature to 1820, is surprised that until 1820, there are so few mentions of the physical appearance of the Jew. In other words, the stereotype was not yet fully blown. Even by 1820, he is surprised that all of that is not yet out, though it was out in Caesar's play, Our Visitors. That is important to realize. As we go a little deeper into the stereotype now, you must always remember that it reverses the order of the ideal. It took both outward appearance and character, and it reverses the order of the ideal. And here I want to go to a document straight away to make it quite clear to you what it means. I will go to the first and again German Dictionary of the German Language of 1808 by a man called Kumpfer. Now, the important thing for you to remember about Kumpfer's dictionary, which is that it is one of the great 18th century dictionaries of language. That Kumpfer was a man of the Enlightenment, not even a romantic, a man of the Enlightenment. And there are certain entries I want to read and translate for you, which will show you the emergence of the stereotype. The entry under Jew is clear. It is the ancient Israelites, but also at times one calls Jew a usurer, one who cheats in commerce, a money Jew, a grain Jew. Then also a man who looks like a Jew, especially if he has a long beard. We go on. And what is the next entrance? The next entrance is Ein Judengesicht, a Jewish face. What is the definition of a Jewish face in comfort? The face of a Jew or Jewess, particular to Jews in its contour, especially any person with such a face is apt to be called a Jew. Definition, and most Jews, a roguish or knavish face. We go on, even beyond this particular, if you like, the entrance of Jews, take up two pages in comfort, no less, but the entrance are in this kind of vein. Another one I quoted to you already, Judenschule, Jew school, synagogue, unlovely service, where everybody talks and there is no dignity. That is its entrance under Judenschule. Now, what I point out to you about this, dictionaries standardize, and therefore expressions like Jewish faith, Jew school, for synagogue, were standardized expressions already in 1808. And they meant, in fact, what I have tried to illustrate to you, they meant, in fact, the anti-ideal to the ideal of beauty that I have said, shifty, ruthless, and ugly. The anti-attitude, instead honesty, dishonesty, bravery, cowardice, proportion, lack of proportion. How is the Jew described, usually now, in Settler and all? And it is the direct opposite to the proportions of Greece. Short legs, high shoulders, awkward gait, gesticulation, short body. That is the description. Now, if you look at these descriptions, short legs, high shoulders, awkward walk, gesticulation, short body. What's wrong with them? Lack of proportion. Lack of the Greek proportion. This is the opposite of the statue of David by Michelangelo. We must add, therefore, it is the antitype. Puniness instead of stature to virility. I will come in one moment. Back right now. For virility becomes here all important. Why? You must remember something else. That with nationalism, you get the rise of the cult of manliness and virility. That from its beginning under Father Jahn, but not only in Germany, under Father Jahn, the rise of nationalism is associated, as I told you before, with the fraternities and the gymnastic organizations. That is to say, the rise of nationalism is associated with self-defense, but self-defense becomes virility and an ideal of a virility. Therefore, the idea here is quite clear. The Jew has a feminine form, not a masculine form, but a feminine form. And in illustrating this, I am now going outside your chronology, because I might as well use the most famous illustration of all of this. The illustration is a book by a young Jew called Otto Weininger in Vienna by the name of Sex and Character. The flesh and cover, sex and terror. A book published in 1903, which summarizes much, and which I'm using for another reason. When you read The Family Muscat, you will see that Heschel reads Weininger. That's one of the books that he reads to emancipate himself from the ghetto. That's one of the books that is specifically meant. Weininger's Sex and Character. What is this? What is this? It is an exaltation of the masculine over above the feminine, the exaltation of the masculine, which comes from the beginning of the century, associated with nationalism, by and large. The feminine is sin, the masculine is redemption. The feminine transforms all values. Woman transforms all values because woman has no ego. Therefore, love with her becomes lust, honesty becomes shiftiness. Woman has no ego. Why? Because she is empirically minded. Weininger was influenced by Kant, by the way. Only the masculine can penetrate to the categorical imperative. Woman remains on the surface. Woman is empirically minded. It has no ego, therefore it has no soul. Immediately, this quite usual thought is translated to the Jews. The Jews have a feminine form, something which arose first, after all, in opposition to the Greek ideal. That's the anti-ideal, the David of Michelangelo. The anti-ideal is feminine, rounded form, not classical form, proportionate form, but the Jew has feminine, rounded form. Therefore, the Jew is also less than ego. He is empirically minded. In the Old Testament, there is no life beyond death. Finally, Jew and woman live only as species, not as individuals. Because they can have no ego, they live only as species, not as individuals. This comes out of the realm of what we call German idealism. The usual accusations are transplanted here into the sexual realm. The Jew is the feminine principle. And therefore, to put it again, the man is the sun and woman is the moon. For the moon is merely a reflection and has no ego of its own. It reflects the sun. Man is the sun and woman is the moon. The Jews are the moon. And so you get a large literature about the Jews as moon people, by which they didn't think of astronauts. They thought of it in these categories. The book by Weininger was enormously popular and enormously influential. Why? Because it hit two nerve centers. The nerve center of the worship of masculinity. You will read more about that in the Crisis of German Ideology. The worship of masculinity. And secondly, and also, I think, very important, the transformation of values. This transformed values. Transformation. Weininger himself added to it. Weininger committed suicide in the same room in which Beethoven had died. This was the final repudiation of his Jewishness. That, of course, made the book all the more popular. He was 21 or 22. I think he was 22 when he did this. In Beethoven's death room, he committed suicide. That's splendid, I think. However that might be, Weininger was of vast importance. And as I said, he occurs in the Family Muscat. He was read by Jews and Gentiles, and I will come back to him when I come to the problem of Jewish self-hate, which is, we might say, a little involved. Yet, There is one thing to which Weininger is not typical, and to that we must come. Because the normative idea of a Jewish male and a Jewish female tend to differ. The Jewish male, puny, feminine, shifty, all the stereotypes. And you might say that that is so because of a sexual rivalry. After all, the same stereotype is applied to the Negro because of a kind of sexual rivalry. But the Jewish woman, it is different. The basic document here comes in 1819, and it is a book most of you have read, Sir Walter Scott's Ivanhoe. Probably one of the most influential books of the 19th century. How many of you have read Ivanhoe?
Oui.
Surprise, congratulations. Sir Walter Scott's Ivanhoe. And here you get it. Sir Walter Scott's portrait of the masculine Jew, Isaac of York, is stereotypical. That is to say, it already has the stereotype. As he says, in a kind of way, Isaac, that is the man, had adopted a national character in which there was much, to say the least, mean and unamiable. To be sure, Sir Walter Scott's descriptions of Isaac's appearance are not yet fully fledged, but almost. But now look at Rebecca. Let us look at Rebecca. What does he say about Rebecca? That becomes normative. The figure of Rebecca might indeed be half compared with the proudest beauties of England, even though it had been judged by a shrewder connoisseur, Prince John. Forget about that. Her form was exquisitely symmetrical and was shown to advantage by a sort of Eastern dress, which she wore according to the fashion of the females of the nation. Her turban of yellow silk suited well with the darkness of her complexion. The brilliance of her eyes, the superb arch of her eyebrows, her well-formed aquiline nose, her teeth as white as pearl, and the profusion of her sable tresses, which, each arranged in its own little spiral of twisted curls, fell down upon as much of a lovely neck and bosom as might be compared to the richest Persian silk. She also wore such silk, exhibiting flowers in their natural colors, embossed upon a purple ground of loveliness, which yielded not to the most beautiful of the maidens who surrounded her. Hardly the stereotype. Notice symmetrical. Notice the proportion. Rebecca begins what we might call the cult of the Jewess. You will find it repeated from now on. The Jew boy is one thing. The Jewess is something else. How can we, it becomes very serious. How can we describe it? The Jewess is beautiful, yet strange. Mysterious, yet beautiful. But such a thing would never be applied in a million years to the male. You have therefore, beginning with Sir Walter Scott, in a very important way, Rebecca becomes a standard character. Rebecca now runs through literature back and forth. I'm sure many of you have read about many Rebeccas. So, what is it? I'm also told by connoisseurs, my eyes are very bad, I'm sorry, I hardly see you these days beyond the third or fourth row, but I'm told by one person who thinks he's a connoisseur that there are more beautiful girls in this class than in any of my previous classes. So this may be true or not, as my eyes aren't so good, I wouldn't venture judging. Nevertheless, however that might be, whether this class is full of Rebeccas, let me don't wear the right kind of mysterious dress. I don't know. What is important for us, therefore, is that from this enormously influential book, Sir Walter Scott's Ivanhoe, you get the idea of the Jewess who transcends the Jewishness. And how does she do it? For it's one thing I have omitted, with the love for a Gentile, a love for a hero. Remember, Rebecca loves the disinherited knight. She loves him, she nurses him. Eventually, when she is accused of witchcraft, the disinherited knight becomes her champion and vanquishes the man who would ravish her. But in the end, of course, she is made more beautiful still by abnegation. She doesn't consummate an intermarriage. That would have been rather impossible in those days. No, she doesn't consummate an intermarriage. Rebecca lets the disinherited knight marry his Gentile lady, while she herself, more beautiful and pale than ever, goes to serve humanity. Now, I realize that's not what Rebecca's doing in real life, but this is neither here nor there. We're dealing with symbolism, not with reality. Remember that. In other words, there is the stereotype, the other stereotype, the stereotype of Rebecca. There is the stereotype of Rebecca. Rebecca, who transcends the Jewishness through love of his Gentile, and who has, therefore, all these kinds of characteristics, appealing, the right proportions, and yet mysterious and oriental, with depths which go back to the desert of Sinai.
Well, never mind.
However this might be, if you're interested, reread Ivanhoe. Now, the interesting thing here is that this goes again to the idea of virility. Those of you who know anything about the growing nationalism know that it has a peculiar concept of woman. That in all nationalistic pictures, up into the 20th century, men are new, women are clothed. That the idea of a woman is always the idea in nationalism of a virginal woman, which comes from Romanticism, a virginal woman, the future mother of the race, the Earth Mother. And therefore, you get on one point the virility, the nude male with his great proportions, and you get on the other hand what we call in German das Keuschebein, the virginal woman. The virginal woman always dressed in pictures and otherwise. So that you have this stereotype again playing into that kind of reality. To sum up, you have, therefore, stereotype and anti-stereotype. But the anti-stereotype is confined to the Jew boy, not to the girl. The girl will always be different and will be annexed ever since Sir Walter Scott. For the Jew boy was considered a direct challenge to the virility of the male society. The male society that was now prized in fraternity, in gymnasts, in art, in everything else, as you will read in the Crisis book, in the male society. And therefore, the Jew boy from the first becomes linked up with sexual fantasy. This is especially clear in Hitler's sexual fantasy in Mein Kampf, where the Jew boy enters as a rapist. There is this sexual fantasy, the Jew as a challenge to Aryan virility. But you have it already in Father Jahn and earlier. The male society, there the Jew becomes involved as the anti-male type. Now I realize that there is a direct parallel in all I have said between the Jew in Europe and the black in America. Everything I have almost said is true as eternally. We therefore come in the stereotype into a generalized thing. Deepened in Germany and Central Europe and in France towards the Jew, but a generalized thing. For even with the black, you have the Negro smell, just as with the Jew, you have the Jewish smell. You have the sexual fantasy about white, about black men, just as you have the fantasy, not only in Hitler before, this idea of virility regarded as a challenge to, let us say, the Gentile virility. All this has definite parallels, and therefore we must say it is almost part of a pattern, of minorities, in that stage. For you have it too generalized not to be. And the answer of why that should be is really rather simple. A minority becomes a symbol. And symbols, as I said at the beginning today, must be four-dimensional. Therefore, you cannot only talk about the Jew and the Negro, about his appearance. You also have to talk about his internal qualities, his reach out, his smell as well. You have to talk about all of it, And here again, the female is an exception. And that has to do with societies which are really male-oriented. From the beginning of the 19th century, certainly in most of Europe, it becomes a virile, male-oriented society. Again, you can do it from the beginning with Father Jan, but you can do it with the end with Nietzsche. After all, Nietzsche's anything is male-oriented. And if you have laughed about Weininger, I don't see why you don't laugh about Nietzsche, because the idea of woman, not of Jews, but of woman is shared by Weininger and Nietzsche. As Nietzsche says in that famous passage, you must take the whip to women. Why essentially? Because women have no being, they have no ego, they are just a reflection of man. They are like a shallow water, which every pebble stirs up. So, you have therefore then, as I said, this stereotype. Finally, we must really take that stereotype very seriously indeed. We must take it seriously indeed, because as a stereotype now, it will not. I wish somehow I could make you understand the popularity of Weininger and the popularity of that kind of thought. Because you've got to understand it. It is very important indeed. And the accusation about the Jews which is brought in here. So far then, we have built the stereotype on what we might call political symbolism, aesthetic symbolism, part of the symbolism of a male-oriented nationalist society. That goes together, a male-oriented nationalist society. The Jew emerges from it as an unchanging symbol. That is to say, a symbol has to have depth. You cannot say, as the Enlightenment said, the Jew became that way through history or historical forces. Thus was the Jew, thus he will always be. Because you must understand, as I'm sure you do, that you cannot change symbols. Once symbols become with mass movement, you cannot just change symbols at will. Symbols tend to be, if I can put it that way, eternal. They tend, at least, to be that way. There are two more building stones, therefore, which we have to put in. First of all, I said that this was first spread by plays and novels, by highly educated people who posed, or were, thought themselves to be the champions of the oppressed. But together with this, we must never forget the proximity of the ghetto, the strange culture of the ghetto, which gave upward wind to this stereotype. The ghetto people from Eastern Europe dressed differently, different beards and hairdo, different culture, different habits, taken as dirty by the West. All of that you must never forget. You must never forget. And that this becomes more and more crucial with the immigration from the ghetto into Western movement. But as this happens, the stereotype loses more and more its religious meaning. More and more its religious meaning. Indeed, Drumont, to quote him again, can say in 1886, truly say, I never insulted a rabbi. Religion need not enter. It is enough that the Jew brings desolation wherever he goes. That is to say, the religious factor now fades and fades rapidly. This stereotype does not need it. It is based on a secular political symbolism. That is to say, a modern political symbolism, because that's what you mean when you say secular. A modern political symbolism, which is based upon classics, upon aesthetics, upon matters of this nature, but which is not based in this regard upon a religion as such. Finally, the last building block is science. For obviously here science must enter as well, but not as yet the science of anthropology. Not today. We're not yet in racism. Anthropology only comes there, but instead the science of psychology. It is the science of psychology which enters now and provides from the 1850s on, the scientific veneer. And it does it under a slogan, a concept, which becomes closely associated with Jews in the end. The concept of degeneration. So that, and I want to make it clear again, we have proceeded from aesthetics and the counter-type through the differences between Rebecca and Isaac, which are always there, to the literature, to the ghetto, which tended to support it in, if you like, objective reality, which always must be there for any symbol, which tended to support it in objective reality. And from that, we get to the scientific part of it. And the scientific part has to do with degeneration, and degeneration as an early but important, if you like, scientific concept. Now, finally, I am quite aware that what I'm lecturing on now and on Wednesday seems to you all very kooky. But remember, millions died because of this. That's what I want to make clear to you. Without this, there could have been no Holocaust. Millions died, so it is not quite as kooky as you think it is. Okay.